Women's history figures prominently in the foundations, in the healing consciousness that flows from the knowledge, the discovery that comes out of the civil rights movement. We must fold in, recover, reclaim, highlight, underline the role of women. We must, in the biblical phrase, gather the fragments that none be lost.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. My name is Gail Leftwich, and I am director of Cambridge Forum, which is now in its 30th year of providing live public forums for the discussion of vital policy issues. Our present theme is Beloved Community, Visions for a World Beyond Racism, in which we explore Martin Luther King's still radical, inspirational vision of a world where differences are respected and people of all backgrounds join together to create a just and inclusive society. We will open our conversation with the observations of scholar and true activist, Reverend Cheryl Townsend Jilks, Associate Minister of Union Baptist Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and MacArthur Associate Professor of African American Studies and Sociology at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Lecturer, teacher, and writer, Reverend Jilks focuses her work primarily on race relations, religious traditions, community organization, and African American women in social change. Her remarks for us are entitled, Not to Ignore the Suffering of Others, African American Women and the Foundations of Beloved Community.
My title tonight, Not to Ignore the Suffering of Others, comes from the writings of African-American women in the late 19th century who were organizing themselves into what eventually became the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, which celebrated its centennial last year. I originally was going to give a long dissertation about African-American women's community history as models for others, and then the title became a little bit more focused the other day. And I want to talk about African-American women and the foundations of beloved community. My remarks tonight have their roots in an offhand comment that was made to me when we were listening to Vincent Harding talk about the importance of Martin Luther King's life for this nation. A young man who's working on his dissertation, wanting to make a point about his newfound feminism or womanism, I'm not sure which, made an offhand comment about Martin Luther King's book, Stride Towards Freedom, that said there was something wrong with it because it only mentioned Joanne Gibson Robinson as a driver during the boycott. And the remark didn't sit right with me. I hadn't looked at Stride Towards Freedom in a very long time, so I couldn't argue with him. But there was something wrong with that remark. There was too much that I had read by and about King that said, no, I'm sure I noticed more in the book. And of course I went back and I reread Stride Toward Freedom. And what I discovered was that laced throughout Stride Towards Freedom were references to all of the different people who were participating in this movement, how that movement was going forward. Not only was Joanne Gibson Robinson mentioned as the driver of a car, and she was mentioned along with several other members of the community as relatively affluent people, professional people who were sharing their resources. It was an example that King was giving and the way in which boundaries of class were being crossed as the process of struggle was going forth. But he talked about her in terms of being the impetus for the boycott, the role of the Women's Political Caucus there in Montgomery in generating the groundswell for this boycott that was a turning point in the history of the world. And it made me think, and I really spent a lot of time meditating on this, because now people are writing the history of the civil rights movement. And there is a tendency to center on the leadership of the civil rights movement, the male ministers who became prominent as spokespersons, and presume because of the particular role they took at that particular moment, that women's roles are automatically secondary to the process. Even for those who are writing from a feminist or womanist perspective, I think there's a failure to see the centrality of women, not only in terms of the movement and the different kinds of leadership that they develop, but in terms of developing the cultural space out of which the movement developed. That when I read King and I hear him talking about love, and then I read Alice Walker and her definition of womanist, and I hear her talking about love, and then I read Howard Thurman and I hear him talking about love, and I listen to my father and hear him talking about love, and then I realize that Howard Thurman's discussions of love are rooted in his grandmother's perspective, Howard Thurman being of that generation who, members of which were often sent to read to their grandparents who had been born in slavery, their grandparents who could not read but wanted to hear the King James Bible read to them every day. And here is Howard Thurman, that wonderful thinking apostle of love, sitting before his grandmother being told what to read. She cannot read, but she can decide what should be read, and not wanting to hear the letters of Paul. Except every once in a while, she wanted to hear 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, we now know that is love, I am a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. And he finally asked her one day, why is it that you don't want to hear the letters of Paul? And she said, when I was in slavery, the master used to have a preacher come, and he would use Paul's letters to say, you will obey your masters, don't steal your master's chickens, be good slaves. And I promised my God that if I ever got my freedom, I would not read that part of the Bible. So she had very carefully selected out that section, except for that piece on love. So one has to realize that if we're going to talk about beloved community, and we're going to talk about King, that love is at the center. And it is a cultured understanding of the importance of this love. As I was thinking about my remarks, I had the opportunity to look at some of the work of Lewis Baldwin, where he very carefully distills what King meant by beloved community. There is the theme, first of all, of the impartiality of God in creating and dealing with human beings. And that assertion has been coming through the mouths of women and their history in the African-American experience. Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, most particularly Sojourner Truth. There is the understanding of the cosmos being gods, being totally embraced by God. And one thinks back on the prayers that are recorded in folklore, the prayer that comes to us in James Weldon Johnson's God's Trombones. And Johnson reminds us that usually in his travels throughout the South, as he listened to sermons, as he listened to prayers, even though the preachers were men, the one who prayed, the one who prepared the way for the preacher, who set the tone, was often the voice of a woman. And in James Weldon Johnson, one gets this wonderful panoramic view of the world, of the cosmos, as being fully embraced by God. And then most of all, most importantly, central to all that we have been struggling about, is a belief in the dignity and worth of all human personality. And finally, there is the understanding that we should hold what Baldwin calls a solidaristic view of society and the world. What we would call the siblinghood of humanity. We must understand and affirm the worth of every human being and find our growth, fulfillment, and purpose through personal and social relationships based on the agape love ethic, that word, that Greek word that undergirds the text of Paul's great poem, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity or love, I am a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. Several years ago, we had a debate over Alice Walker's term, womanist. Some of you may have heard that term. And I love the term. The first time I read it, I happened to go by a bookstore right down the corner of Church Street here in 1983. And there was her book, her new book, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. And I whipped out my poor little struggling charge card and ran in, bought the book, ran back to my office, and I opened it. And on the very first page was a definition, something like a dictionary definition, of something called womanist. We've learned later that she had used the term in a book review, and she got tired of editors' queries because no such word existed. Well, now the word exists. But she went on to define it, and some of you may be familiar with it. She talks about the roots of it comes from womanish. Then she went on to point to its roots in dialogues, mother-daughter dialogues. Mother, I'm walking to Canada and taking a few of the members of the enslaved community with me. Response from mother, it would not be the first time. Or mother, why are all our cousins beige and brown and black and why are we all these different colors? Response by mother, the colored race is like a flower garden. And it goes on that way. So there is a root of consciousness in the dialogues of mothers and daughters, in women's voices. The part of the definition that I like is where Walker takes the word love, and she talks about loves the spirit, loves food, loves roundness. That someone who is womanist is committed to the health and wholeness of the entire people, male and female. There's a communal sense there. There's a model of beloved community really built into the definition. And then she goes on to say one loves love and loves herself regardless. And as I read that, I heard echoes of one colleague of mine from SCLC who liked to get up and talk about the fact that King's notion of love was something that was also speaking to a community, an oppressed community, that was being called to self-hatred by the sin of racism. And that when one says loves herself regardless, I thought of my friend saying, if the commandment is to love one's neighbor as oneself, how can I hate myself and love my neighbor? And then one hears the call to healing that is so important. So the insistence on one's humanity that is the basis of beloved community is also in the historical voices of African American women. If I had my normal 2-hour seminar, I would walk you through the history of African American women. I would take you to hear the voices of someone like Sojourner Truth. We hear so much about her "Aren't I a Woman" speech that we almost don't know that she was an evangelist who talked about a lot of things. She used to set up her banner saying, "Proclaim liberty across the land." That she, after she got her freedom, after the Civil War was over, went to Washington, D.C. She desegregated the streetcars in Washington, D.C. She encouraged women who were in contraband camps to fight for themselves and their children. She helped to found Freedmen's Hospital. These are things we very often don't talk about in terms of her life. Her life was one that was full of commitment and exhortation, insisting on her humanity and insisting on the humanity of others. I would take you to hear the voice of Harriet Tubman that insisted on freedom for her community, but that's also a biblical voice. I love Harriet Tubman, and one of the things that kept her going was a vision, her vision of the beautiful city, that city four square with its three gates on the east, its three gates in the north, its three gates in the south, its three gates in the west, and her assumption, well, if anything happens to me, I should get through one of the gates in the south. And one thinks of King's sermon, the three dimensions of a complete life that looks also at that city and talks about the height and the width and the depth of a life being equal. Or I would walk you through the organizing moments of the National Association of Colored Women here in Boston through the Women's Era Club, provoked through the assault on their humanity into bringing over 200 already existent clubs together, and between 1893 and 1896, eventually welding together two national organizations, the Colored Women's League, organized by Mary Church Terrell, the National Federation of Afro-American Women, organized by women that included Mrs. Booker T. Washington, Margaret Murray Washington. The ability of these women in the late 19th century to walk between the conflicting words of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois to insist on their humanity and to say that they have suffered, but they are not unmindful of the suffering of others. If I had a lot of time this evening, I would walk you through a history that takes us through the National Association of Colored Women to the leadership of Mary McLeod Bethune and allows us to see her organizing the National Council of Negro Women and their insistence in their discovery of women of color worldwide in putting together program books in three languages. Look at the struggles we are having today in terms of including people of various languages in our public life. But here are women in the first third of the 20th century insisting that if we are going to build community, if we're going to reach out, if we're going to organize, then we must do it in a way that people can understand. So their first program book was in French, Spanish, and English. If I had time tonight, I would walk you through the diversity of ways that women organized to affirm their humanity and to affirm the humanity of our sisters. We're going through a period now where there's an obsession with the issue of class. People are critiquing affirmative action and saying, well, affirmative action should focus on social class. Of course, it's a contradiction that if one is going to be qualified for professional jobs, by the time one is qualified, one most likely will be middle income or on one's way to being middle class. But then there's the discovery, the sort of insidiousness of racism, that one goes to visit communities where programs are put together for poor children who happen to be concentrated in black neighborhoods, and then when they succeed, they become colonized by white middle-class parents who want the same thing for their children. So we have to be careful not to be fooled by this. And these women were not fooled by these issues of class. They saw their privileges as resources to be used. They saw their ability to be cultured, something to be shared with their sisters who were working in kitchens. As religious women, they set for themselves goals. For instance, Baptist women said, we should go out and befriend, each of us should go out and befriend one white woman. This was their notion. Each of us would go out and befriend one white woman and persuade her to the struggle against color, in those days they said color prejudice instead of racism, and then get her to pledge to talk to her husband. At the same time, these missionary women, these Baptist missionary women, said to the majority of their sisters, at that time 85% of the black female population was working as household domestics, these Baptist women said, we will try to teach our employers. So this insistence on their humanity, regardless of their position, speaks to us today. What do we say to people in a variety of circumstances who question their agency because of lack of resources? I would say, let us walk through that history. It's important to fold in women's history. And let me just make this point quickly and sit down. We must fold women's history into the mix as we analyze and reflect on the importance of the civil rights movement, the importance of the contribution of King. When I go back and read Parting the Waters, my ear for women's consciousness, my ear for women's experience, it is pricked when I hear E.D. Nixon saying that he's making phone calls to gather these preachers together because they owe these washerwomen. So there's a consciousness there that we must reclaim and recover and uncover and show the way in which the voices of women, although not seen on the evening news when Walter Cronkite told us what was going on in the South, was very clearly there at the very foundations of thinking. Going back and looking at Stephen Oates' book and discovering that one of King's lasting images was growing up in the Sunday school with what women had poured into his head. So We must fold in, recover, reclaim, highlight, underline the role of women. We must, in the biblical phrase, gather the fragments that none be lost. Women's history figures prominently in the foundations, in the healing consciousness that flows from the knowledge, the discovery that comes out of the civil rights movement that gives us the beloved community. Let me close with one little vignette from Toni Morrison's book, Beloved. There's a scene in the book, and some of you may be familiar with this, where the community has come together to celebrate the liberation of Baby Suggs' daughter. And it starts with a few blackberry pies, and it grows to a major community event. 90 people sit down and feast together. Then at the end of the meal, jealousy sets in. People start turning their backs on one another. And Morrison gives us this description of community just coming apart, falling apart, people's commitment to one another just disappearing in jealousy and antagonism. And early the next morning, when you turn the page, she tells us, it was so quiet, the four horsemen thought they were too late. Community, our commitment to one another, our insistence on each other's humanity is what keeps away those horsemen of the apocalypse that would re-enslave us in racism and its consequences. Thank you very much.
The floor is now open for your questions and comments. Please step up to the microphone.
I have sat in so many conferences over the last 20 years and listened to women in the movement talk about Dr. King. They loved him. They loved being in his presence. They were moved by his leadership, but they knew that he did not work well with women. And there are temptations to put this man on a pedestal. He's an American icon, and he's an icon that we all need, quite frankly, and deeply, but he was not perfect. And especially on the issues of dealing with women, he was not perfect. And part of the reason why we didn't understand the role of women in the movement much sooner is because at first what we had to read about the movement were the books written by Martin. And it took 20 more years to uncover the history and to hear the voices of women and to understand how important they were. And so I think we can't let him off so easy. He had some things to learn. Now, he would only be 68 today, and I'd like to think that he was the kind of person who would have changed. I've watched James Cone change in front of our eyes in his books, one after another, through the 70s and 80s, and I think Martin would have done the same thing. But the Martin Luther King we knew in the 50s and 60s had a lot to learn about a lot of the things that his mother and his grandmothers, both of whom he loved in very different ways, but very profoundly. And he grew up in a church where he was deeply sustained by the women of the church. And what happened was he fell into the image of the black male preacher. And that's how he conducted himself, by and large, in the movement. We need to look at that real hard.
One of the things, you're right about going back and critiquing the way you said he fell into the image of the black preacher. No, he was a black preacher. He was part of what is a very hyper-masculine world, and he was only 26 years old. I tell my students, when I talk about Martin Luther King in the classroom, I say, all right, I want you all to remember when you have your 26th birthday, think of this day, because it's hard to fathom what it is to have finished. Most people do not finish their PhDs by the age of 26. Most people do not pastor a major house. That is the language that ministers use for the kind of church that Dexter Avenue was. It was what we would call a major house. And it was not only a major house, it was a middle-class major house. It was what was known as a silk stocking church. And one is being told at the age of 26, you will act with authority, you will have authority, you will not let your guard down at any time. And we tend to center our critique especially, I've been reading manuscripts that have talked about the conflict between King and Ella Baker, where someone who is older than enough to be one's mother is brought in to be the executive director. And there were what sociologists call dilemmas and contradictions in status there. But
that's good.
Okay. But there's also a hyper, I guess I was responding to the hyper critiquing of King that distorts the situation, that the young man distorted what was going on in Stride Toward Freedom. And also the fact that, no, we did have some other books. We had Daisy Bates' book on Little Rock. We had Septima Clark's book, but people were not paying attention to those things. And what I have had problems with is the diminution in the current writing of the roles of those women. Daisy Bates was not just simply a member of the Arkansas NAACP. She was the leader of the Arkansas NAACP. And so, you know, a better understanding of those voices and also seeing the voices that were there, because King does mention the women, but nobody pays any attention. There's a tendency to look beyond the women, to only look at the preachers and to only look at their words. The press did that and helped us for, and there was also a practicality there. The women in Montgomery, such as Joanne Gibson Robinson, mm-hmm. got their paychecks from the state of Alabama. Mm-hmm. They couldn't go on television. Septima Clark, her sorority gave a testimonial luncheon in her honor, and none of her sorority members would be photographed with her because they were school teachers. You know, the leadership class at that particular moment in African American history consisted of preachers and teachers, and the preachers were men, and the teachers, for the most part, were women. And when we look at other aspects of the movement, for instance, Selma, where Amelia Boynton is beaten, and all of a sudden, the men who are the school teachers come forward and march publicly. By not deconstructing all of those little elements, we miss the shifts, those dramatic shifts where people risked their livelihoods, not only their lives, but sometimes I think it's easier to die than to give up one's livelihood. Not to have a livelihood in this society is to be consigned to the class of the living dead. And we don't recognize that sometimes. So what I would like to see is a rereading of the documents that we do have and a real recognition of how much the base, the substructure of what emerged as the civil rights movement emerged on the sensibilities, on a culture that was shaped by women's voices. And then when people start digging at it and poking fun at the love ethic, to realize it is not just King they are pointing at, but a foundation of men's and women's voices that produced Martin Luther King and gave voice to a way of surviving and change that emerged from a people who were enslaved in this nation.
Thank you, Reverend Jilks. You have been listening to a special beloved community program at Cambridge Forum, a free public forum in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, supported by the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities and co-sponsored by the First Parish in Cambridge Unitarian Universalist, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us.